Welcome to the Museums and That podcast, where each episode, stop laughing, where each episode we have a chinwag and serve you the steaming hot tea on the things that museum people love the most. We're your hosts, Meg and Sarah from Leeds Museums and Galleries, and we get to know the people behind the objects by asking them the questions that you really want to know. Doing a little dance.
Yep.
Brilliant. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Meg. How are you?
Hello. To be honest, really sweaty.
Hello. Okay. To be honest, what? Sorry, go on.
Are you having a stroke?
Maybe. I don't. It's really hot in here.
Yeah, I know. This is what I'm saying. I was saying I'm really sweaty.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, when pregnant women, I'm not pregnant, but you know, when pregnant women like sit down and have like fans and like ice.
Yeah.
Yeah,
have a minute.
They're like creating a person. I feel like I need that.
My sister sent a message to our like family group the other day, and she said, top tip, if you fill a hot water bottle with like freezing cold water and either put it in your bed or take it around with you, it obviously has the same effect and cools you down. And I was like, why have I never thought of that?
Oh my God.
Isn't that good? Shout out to Hayley for that.
Hayley, God bless you, my child.
A stroke of genius.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, yeah, I'm definitely going to go do that. How are you? What's been going on?
Yeah, good. I keep thinking it's Wednesday today and I don't know why. I think it's because I'm at home today and I've been out on site quite a lot, and so I've got myself a little bit confused. But yeah, I'm good. That's all I have. How are you?
Fine. Yeah, I feel like just really deflated. Do you feel deflated?
Yeah, I go through fits and bursts with it, and then... Actually, this week I have something to look forward to, though, because I'm going to go and get my hair cut.
Oh,
it hasn't been cut since January, and I'm going to get it, like, lobbed.
In one podcast episode, I can't remember which one it is, but you say January really weird, and every time someone says January, I hear it in your voice. You're like, January.
January. Yeah. I don't know. Oh, how strange.
I hear it in all of my nightmares.
Quite haunting, yeah. Yeah, I get that.
Anyway.
So that's what I've got to look forward to.
I text Sarah this week because I was watching a program and I was like, remind me to talk about this on the podcast because it was ridiculous. Yes. It's a program behind the scenes at the Ritz. Have you seen it? Did you watch it?
I still didn't watch it, no. I am going to watch it. I keep doing this. I've got my list of things I am going to watch.
Right. It's literally insane. It's just like everything that goes on behind the Ritz, and all the people that work there are wild. And it's got like, firstly... The music for it is the same as the theme tune to It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is just funny. So everything's just a bit funny. And like they have on random celebrities that have...
Right,
like,
so why was Alistair Cook there? Alistair Cook off of cricket, why was he there?
A good looking man. He was just having like an afternoon tea or something. And then like random celebrities are there that they just film, like Penny Lancaster turns up. But the whole thing behind all of them is that they're just like, yeah, the Ritz is really good. Like, no one's really got anything to say other than like the Ritz is great. And then I was watching it, and out of nowhere, Mo Salah off of football turns up, and they're interviewing him, and he's just like, "Yeah, I absolutely love the Ritz." And Mo Salah's favourite thing is the Ritz's beef Wellington.
That's hilarious.
And I was like,
and kind of weird.
Yeah, I was like, is literally anyone else watching this? I don't understand.
I know I've watched programs like that in the past, like the behind the scenes of the world's most luxurious hotel and things. And often, I think it was somewhere in sort of the Middle East, because hospitality is a totally different thing over there to how we work in the hospitality industry. And I do find it fascinating and how everyone has to operate like this big family, because it's just relentless and it's hard work. And it's just
Have you ever worked in hospitality?
No, so my previous role when I worked for an agency in Leeds, I looked after a group of hotels. So I worked with them and got sort of behind the scenes and things, and brilliant people, but absolutely bonkers for good reason.
Yeah, I did a stint as I was a barista and a waitress.
Yeah.
And I truly think that everyone, you know how like is it in Switzerland that everyone has to go into the army? Or something.
There's a few countries.
Iceland.
I'm not sure about Switzerland.
Somewhere like that. There's a country where everyone has to go into the army. Basically, I think that here, everyone should have to go into hospitality and work as a waitress or a waiter for like at least 6 months. Because it really teaches you, firstly, to be a nice person, but also just how awful human beings can really be to you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a special kind of person that can talk badly to a waiter or a waiter. That's one of my pet peeves, actually, that and being late.
Yeah, of which I always am. So I'm surprised we're still friends because I am generally late to everything.
You're not late.
I try really hard, but things just crop up, you know?
I've literally got, if anyone's ever late to meet me for anything, like, I'll probably act nice about it, and, like, it doesn't bother me, but I will never, ever forget it. I'll never forget it, and I'll never ever, you'll never be able to claw it back with me. Anyway, enough about like the Ritz. Who have we got on today? Finally, I'm excited. Yes. I wasn't really excited about everyone else, but I've been really looking forward to this one.
Well, this is one of your favourite parts of our collection, probably the favourite part of our collection, would you say?
It's pretty much the best.
Archaeology with Kat Bax, Catherine Baxter, who is our curator of archaeology and numismatics, which is medals and coins and things. So she's coming on today and she's going to talk to us more specifically around human remains and death. So we have got a bit of a disclaimer on this one.
So disclaimer for this one is that this episode contains discussions about death, burials and human remains in the context of museum collections, ethics and conservation. So basically please skip this episode if that isn't for you.
Yeah.
Which would be a shame because it's going to be a really interesting one, to be fair. Also, another disclaimer is that this is a really long episode because basically we couldn't stop asking questions. We had too many. And by we, I mean me.
Yeah. And Kat is really passionate about it and she's really passionate about the ethics as well. So it's Kat Baxter's episode of Museums and That.
Enjoy. Kat Bax, you're here. Welcome.
I am here. I'm very excited.
Awesome. I keep calling you Kat Bax and I feel like that's literally not your full name. So please could you tell our podcast listeners your actual name and also what you do?
So my full name is Catherine Baxter, but everybody calls me Kat. I'm the curator of archaeology for Leeds Museums and Galleries. So I look after all the archaeological collections for the museum service and the numismatics collections as well, all the coins and medals. And it's my job to look after them and to research them and to get everybody really excited and engaged with them as well.
And that you definitely do.
You love archaeology.
I do.
I feel like archaeology is my best one as well. It's literally the best. Yeah, I literally love it. And also, I live really close to Kirkstall Abbey, so it's, you know.
It is an absolute dreamy site to have for Leeds Museums, isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just an honour to work there, I think. Sometimes I go there and I think, I can't believe I work here.
It's pretty wild. Yeah. In the last episode, Sarah was like, oh, Kat looks after the biggest thing in our collection. Smez, you were going for Kirkstall Abbey, right?
Yeah. Because I always forget that it's part of the collection. Like, all the sites are in a way, but it's different. It's different because it's one of its own.
It is. And it's certainly the biggest sort of single object, I suppose, that we have to look after, but luckily there's a whole team of people there all the time to look after it, so it's not just me on my own.
At this one time I was in the store with Neil. Neil used to be our geology curator, and he was like, Meg, guess what this is, like, can you have a little guess, like, what you think this is? It literally, in our store, like 1.3 million objects, could be anything. I was like, looked a bit like a rock. I was like, is it like a little piece of Kirkstall Abbey? And he was like, yeah, it's like a dinosaur vertebrae. I was like, it's close. It's close though. Right.
I mean, they do look quite similar, to be fair.
Okay, Kat, so today you are coming on to talk about human remains.
I am.
Which is very exciting and very interesting because I feel like we've got lots of questions for you.
Okay.
So obviously we have human remains in our collection, right?
Yeah, certainly do.
So I want to talk about the ethics of that, because I know that we're really big on that, you're really big on that. And obviously we've got like human remains working group and stuff like that. So to kickstart, really, why do we have human remains in our collection and what kind of value do they have to the collection, I guess?
So the human remains collection is actually quite broad. I think usually we just think about archaeological remains as in human skeletons or mummified remains, particularly Egyptian mummified remains. But actually, there's human remains in a lot of different collections in the museum, because it's basically any material made out of human material. So it can be teeth, it can be hair, it can be objects that are made out of human bone, but it can also be human skeleton. So it's quite broad. And it's all in the museum for lots of different reasons. In terms of archaeology, I think people have been really interested in human skeletons for as long as the museum service has been going. If you look back through the registers, sort of 200 years ago, people were going out to different places in the world and bringing back, you know, human skulls or acquiring human remains from all over the place for sort of scientific interest. It's completely different today. We would never do that. We would never go and seek to acquire human remains from different places. But if there's an archaeological excavation in the Leeds area and human remains are in the way of commercial development, so just say they're building a road and there's a graveyard there, the skeletons have to be removed for their own protection because they're going to get destroyed. So then the choice is, are they reburied or do they come to the museum? And that's a discussion that has to be had. It depends on what license they have for that. So then they may come to the museum because they're seen as being scientifically important and that we can look after them. And actually it's better for the skeletons that they're not destroyed in the, you know, in building the road or the housing development, and that they're protected. So there's a lot of reasons why we would collect human remains, but obviously human remains are not museum objects like other objects. They are the remains of once living people, and we're really aware of that. And archaeologists in the field are really aware of that as well. So we have to balance the sort of ethics of, is it okay to have these human remains? Because we don't have consent. We don't have that person's consent to take them out of the ground. But then the needs of the living kind of outweigh the dead's resting place, because as a species, like as people today, we need to also build houses and build roads and move people out of the way who've been buried there in the past. Yeah. So it's a real balancing act, I think. More and more, I would say that human remains are excavated and they're given a couple of years to analyse them, and then they're reburied. That usually happens more and more now. But occasionally we will take in human remains from an excavation.
When there's been an excavation and there are human remains, how do you kind of decide how many you collect, or how, like, do you base it? What kind of questions do you ask, I guess, is the question that I have.
If we're going to take human remains from a site, we would probably take them all unless there were huge conservation issues with them, because we couldn't really choose which individuals we thought were more important. But during the excavation process, there'll be an osteoarchaeologist, so a specialist in human bone, who will analyse those remains. So we don't just have human skeletons with no information. We also get all the information with those skeletons, which we can then use those skeletons for education, for display, for research, and all the other wonderful things that we can do, things that we can tell about the past from these wonderful individuals in our collection.
So one of the most popular exhibitions that we've had was, like, recently, was the Skeletons Are Buried Bones exhibition, which you worked on at the City Museum.
I did, yeah, it was great.
Yes, so that was, I think, like, the year that I started, that was one of the first exhibitions. Yeah, one of the first exhibitions I worked on, and I was so excited, and, like, I took my grandparents to it when they came to visit. But it was amazing because I think people have such a fascination with human remains and with death and with graves and what graves can tell us. And the thing about that exhibition was that you could see how people had died. They had, like, wounds on the skeletons, and it was all about, like, the stories that the bones could tell us, right?
So yeah, that's right. It's all looking at pathologies of bones, and sadly the stories you can usually tell from human skeletons are sad ones, you know.
Yeah.
Which isn't great, but they can tell us so much about living conditions and diet and movement of people. So they can tell us an awful lot, not just about individuals but about populations. That's really important. So there's a lot of what we know comes from that information.
Yeah, I know one of the things in that exhibition was we asked, like, the public for their opinion. Oh my gosh, that's Sunny from next door. Can you hear him?
I can hear the dog. Yeah.
That's Sunny. He's such a good
Sunny.
Really?
Yeah, he rest in peace.
He's really sweet. Sorry, one of the things in the exhibition was we asked visitors to, like, share their thoughts on how they felt about having human remains on display. So what kind of things do people have to say about it? Because I know you did some research on that from the, like, results we got from that and the feedback we got. What kind of things do people have to say?
Yeah, so we thought it was really important because we decided that we'd do this exhibition on skeletons with the Museum of London. And instead of having the human remains collection in the store, we thought if we have these remains, actually we should just really display them and tell these people's stories, and then ask our visitors, do you think this is okay? And then that information would then feed in to our human remains policy going forward, so sort of inform what we do in the future, because you don't know how people feel if you don't ask them. So that's really the bottom line, really. So we displayed these 12 individuals in the exhibition. We asked loads of questions, mainly about, well, the two main ones were, is it okay for museums to have human remains in their collections and to display them and to allow research on them? And the second main question that we wanted the answer to was, is it okay to let the public take photographs of human remains on display and then to go and share those photographs on social media? Is that okay? So we had tons of feedback, and we asked people just to share their thoughts. And you know what? People were really thoughtful in their responses. You know, we had really long, really thoughtful responses to these questions. Some people weighing up on either side, some people feeling very, very strongly either way. Really intelligent questions. People saying, well, can't you just 3D print the skeletons and rebury the original? You know, what about their religious beliefs? But then a lot of other people saying, you know, human bone is just what's left over. It's not a person. You can take my skeleton. We have several offers of people's skeletons during this exhibition.
Brilliant.
So it was wonderful in terms of education. We had medical students saying, you know, this is a great resource for us. We can come and look at human remains and all these evidence of diseases from the past. So we had a huge range of responses. I mean, I collated all of the responses that we collected through lots of different ways. And it was about 82% of people were generally in favour of human remains in museums. So that was really encouraging for us. That gives us the confidence going forward that actually we know it's controversial and we know there are lots of ethical considerations about how we use human remains, but our public in general are quite behind us, which is very good to know. Interestingly, the photography question was much lower support. It was about 62% of people supported us on photography. People were way more conflicted over photography, which I found really interesting, actually.
I was just about to say, when you, because I've been to, we went to the catacombs in Paris and things, and there was people taking selfies with them and stuff, and I felt that that was wrong, because especially because it's about place and context, and it's like, these people are buried here and you're taking, you know, there's something weird. And, you know, but then again, am I a hypocrite, because I went and visited that and saw it and I actually have no connection to that space. I just found it interesting and I wanted to know about why and how and what happened, really. But then maybe in a museum context, it's sort of taking it out of those spaces. And I think that's the thing that maybe people feel conflicted about. But then also, a bit like how we have, you know, GDPR and all of that information, you take pictures of, you're essentially taking pictures of strangers for a start, and then that's on your personal phone and in your personal like effects. That's another consideration as well. Like, is that okay? And at what point
it
are we crossing
completely
a line?
And we put like a big sign up during the exhibition, and we put a sign up next to the display of Nessie Amun, our Egyptian mummy, saying that respectful photography is permitted. And we've stated, you know, these are the remains of a once living person or once living people. So just pause and have a think about what you're taking a photo of. And in a sense, I have no problem with people taking photos of an exhibition and then sharing them, because that's just how the exhibition looks. I think I'm more upset when people doctor images or maybe take silly selfies, and you sort of think, come on, this is a person here. There's a person. If this was a member of your family, would you think this was okay? So I think there are lots of questions around it, definitely.
This leads me on nicely to talking about something that I've been wanting to ask you about for so long, and it's mummifying Alan, Kat. Right, so basically, everyone, there was this documentary on Channel 4, probably like 8-9 years ago, called Mummifying Alan, right? Kat, have you seen it yet?
I have seen it, yes. I have seen it.
Okay, great. So in summary, this man called Alan, who was sadly terminally ill, was married to an Egyptologist, and they were both really interested in mummification. And after he died, it was his wish to donate his body to, I can't remember which university it was.
It's the University of York. So, well, basically, Stephen Buckley and Joanne Fletcher, who work at the University of York, they were the two who actually mummified him, who we work with quite closely, actually. And they have done work on Nessie Amun as well, like they're really interested. But I think his actual mummified body was donated to King's College, London, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
I think he's in London, yeah.
But one of the things, like, I was reading up, because I've always been really fascinated by it, and when I first watched it, I was like, whoa, this is, like, just, it's something that's just so, I never thought would be on TV. And the weird thing about it was, or the kind of, maybe not weird is the right word, but the, at the beginning, Alan knows that he's going to pass away because he's terminally ill. So yeah. He's in the program at the beginning. And then as the scientists and kind of people working on his body are working on it, you can hear Alan's voice and you see his body throughout the whole of the episode of the program. You see kind of everything that they're doing to it. And that's what he wanted, like that he knew that his body was going to be that way. So this, I've seen like people online kind of talking about the program and just enjoying it and finding it fascinating. I think no one would argue that it's a fascinating thing, but it's just so strange to be sat in your living room and seeing the remains of a person who was on the same program speaking, you know.
Yeah,
it's an interesting like thing. I don't know, I think I felt okay with it because you know that it's his wishes and that's
I think that's it. I think it's that matter of consent that I mentioned earlier, this idea of it being somebody's wish. So human remains in museums, we don't have their consent for them to be in a museum. We think, you know, maybe Nessie Amun in his lifetime, if he knew he was going to end up in Leeds and people were still going to be talking about him in 3,000 years time, maybe he would have thought that was amazing, or maybe he would have been absolutely horrified, and we'll never know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Or any of the human remains in our collection. But with Alan, you know, it is exactly what he wanted. So in a way it was quite beautiful in a way that he got his wish. But I did find it slightly uncomfortable at times watching it on telly, because we're not used to, the thing is, this is part of our culture as well, isn't it? We're not used to being this close to death. We're distanced from death in our everyday lives. So when we're confronted with it, and I think this is another one of the issues really around human skeletons in museums, but also preserved bodies in museums that have been mummified either in the ancient Egyptian practice or naturally mummified, like bog bodies, for instance. I think people confronted with that, it's almost like being confronted with your own mortality, that you know you're going to end up like that too. And I think that's difficult for a lot of people. But with Alan, I think he had the death that he wanted. So I feel, although I did find it difficult to watch, and I got very upset, it was very emotional, I feel like he got the death that he wanted. So I was quite happy for him at the same time. But that's one way, really going off on a slight tangent, but it's one way that archaeology can really feed into debates today. Because remember, well, back in 2016, might be before you started, but I worked on an exhibition called Dying Matters, and we worked with an organization called Dying Matters who are amazing. They support people to talk about death, like just to talk about death in everyday life, to plan for their own deaths. We should all be planning for our own deaths. We should be talking about it, about death, dying, bereavement, because it's going to happen to everybody. So why don't we talk about it all the time? And it's using archaeological objects and different objects across the museum departments to talk about things like make a death plan, make a will, think about organ donation, you know, all these practical things that you can do to organize your own death. And I think they're a really fabulous organization, this idea of taking control of your own end of life. And I think that sort of links back to mummifying Alan, because he got what he wanted and he made it really clear and he talked about this.
You touched on it briefly then, but one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was about preservation. And I know you mentioned bog bodies and obviously mummification we've been talking about. Is it the Museum of Dublin Museum that has...
Oh yeah, Ireland, you have several, yeah.
And they're just so preserved, and like, you can see their hair and stuff like that. So basically how are they more preserved than others? Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it completely depends on the conditions of burial. So whereas Egyptian mummies, well actually no, early Egyptian mummies were naturally mummified by hot sand, and later on people intervened to mummify individuals. There are ways that you can be naturally mummified, and a bog body, what are known as bog bodies, are these kind of natural mummies. So because they're preserved in peat bogs, there's a specific conditions in peat bogs where there's like anaerobic conditions, so there's no oxygen, low temperatures are ideal, there's high acidity, and the alkali levels are similar to vinegar. So it's kind of, the body doesn't break down, it's not allowed the conditions needed for like bacteria and other things to break it down. So it's been described to me in the past as a bit like pickling a fruit. You can think of bog chemistry as a delicious chutney, if you like. So you have these really specific conditions, which mean that the bones may actually decompose because of the acidity, but things like the organic material, your skin, your nails, your hair, that will preserve incredibly well. And it also causes sort of the leatheriness of the skin as well. So they've got a very specific look. And it means that objects with these people, like leather sandals, for instance, will also survive really, really well. But it means that when they're taken out of the bog, the minute they hit the ordinary atmosphere, they will start to decompose. Oh, so you have to be really, really careful about preservation. They're really fragile.
Because unlike Meg, I haven't stood in the office and talked at length with you about bog bodies. So forgive me if this is a very obvious question, but is it in more specific cultures, or did it happen everywhere just over a certain time period?
Really, in terms of European bog bodies, we're talking about mainly the Iron Age period across Europe. It tends to be colder climates as well, because the lower temperature sort of aids that preservation as well in the bogs. So you have closest to home is probably Lindelman, who was found in the northwest of England, so near Manchester. I believe he's on display in the British Museum. Oh, I know he went to the Manchester Museum many years ago now for an exhibition, so I went to see him then. So again, there's lots of ethical issues, and actually Manchester Museum addressed these ethical issues really well in terms of how people feel about this sort of preservation. I find that people find it more difficult the more preserved a person is. Mm. And I don't know, maybe this is something I should ask you too. Do you feel differently about seeing, say, a human skeleton on display or seeing a mummified person in whatever form with hair and skin and nails? Do you feel differently about that?
I do.
Yeah.
I feel that it's easier to contextualize and see that body as a person with a life and a soul and a family and everything else, whereas a skeleton feels so far removed. Especially because, you know, I have no scientific background, and I have not, you know, broken bones and things as well. So I can't relate to it at all. And it almost becomes depersonalized, I suppose, is the best way I can think about it. I don't know about you, Meg.
I feel like I'm more affected by being in the presence of human remains when I know who the person is. So like maybe seeing a bog body in a museum wouldn't affect me as much as if I went to Sudley Castle last week in the Cotswolds, and it's where Catherine Parr lived, and yeah. It's where her tomb is, and they the story about her tomb goes that, say, it's a story, literally historical fact, in the 1700s I think it was, some people discovered her tomb and opened it up, and her body was really well preserved. It was in some cloth or something. Kat, you might know more about that than me.
I don't know what her specific preservation would have been.
She was really well preserved, and okay. there's clippings of her hair, and stuff was taken from her grave that they now have in the collection there. And there's like, I think they have a couple of her teeth. That really affected me, like seeing that, like a lock of Catherine Parr's hair in a case, like that really affects me more so than potentially, I don't know, seeing a skeleton or seeing a body of someone that I didn't know, because I know more of the history of that person, you know?
No, it does completely make sense. And the research we did through the skeletons exhibition kind of echoes that the closer somebody is to the human remains in terms of time, in terms of, you know, people tend to think it's okay to display someone who died 2000 years ago, but 150 years ago, maybe not so much. People, you know, if they know their name or not, seem to be affected by that. You know, even that sort of level of engagement of someone being from where you're from or not from where you're from affects, you know, people's responses. It's really complex and quite emotional and understandable as well. There's no right or wrong response. But that's what makes human remains so powerful as well, as a means of engagement, because you are sort of looking at yourself in a way. And it's kind of universal. And it is crazy that we don't address death more, considering that's the end point of all of us. You know, it's a shared experience that we will all have. And I think human remains are very powerful in that way. But I will say as well, even if you don't know who somebody is, they can have a profound impact. Mm. I'm just sort of thinking about the ways human remains are used to have discussions about life today. And there's the remains of a woman in the Yorkshire Museum who's known as Ivory Bangle Lady, for instance, and she was unearthed in York and lived in York in the 4th century, and she was buried with really nice grave goods, so she's quite an elite person. And they did lots of scientific analysis on her and found that she was originally from North Africa. So actually, even though we don't know anything about her apart from that, the fact is that we can sort of use her remains in a way to talk about things like immigration and the fact that there were people of African origin living in York in the 4th century, and immigration is nothing new, and you know, it's cosmopolitan even back in Roman times. And so we can be sort of really robust in our arguments about the way people move around all the time. It's not a new concept, but we can use specifically archaeology and specifically human remains to inform that kind of conversation. So they are really important in lots of different ways.
Just thinking about, I like knowing the stories behind human remains. When you discover a grave, how important or how much research goes into trying to find out who that person was? Like, so researchers would try to put a name to that person always?
If possible. I mean, just say a burial, like a Methodist burial ground had been excavated from like the 1800s, then there may be burial registers and there would be research conducted to try and match up who these people are, absolutely. And even contact living relatives if that was possible. So there's all sorts of routes, but with archaeology, generally speaking, you're not going to find a name because it can go back so far. But certainly in the last few hundred years, it's possible. Yeah, absolutely.
If you could discover or like connect human remains to a particular historical figure that hasn't yet been discovered, who would it be?
You know what? That is a really difficult question. And there are loads of archaeologists out there searching for quite high profile people. But I'm not personally that interested in sort of famous elite people. I'm really interested in ordinary people and what ordinary people are up to. I'm personally more fascinated by somebody who lived in the Leeds area, you know, 1,000 years ago, who was just a standard person, because often, because archaeology is so skewed, it's the more elite objects that are always going to be found. I feel like ordinary people need more of a voice. So for me, finding Joe Bloggs, you know, from the early Middle Ages would be, for me, an absolute dream. In an ideal world, we'd be burying him. I'm just saying that as well.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, because like what you said about the nurse from the 4th century who came over from North Africa, that speaks more to me and makes me feel a bit more humble and, you know, sound about, because immigration has always been a massive subject, and even more so at the minute with Brexit and everything else that we have going on, not to dwell. But I find that more interesting, like you say, than a king or a queen or anyone else like that, because arguably their history's kind of written to a certain extent. And yes, it can be rewritten and changed, but I don't know, I don't have any link to it. And especially for what we do at LMG, which is, you know, really, we concentrate on our local history, and we're a civic service, and that's kind of our objective, is to look out for those people's stories. I think that's really
important to us. And I think because in the skeletons exhibition, most of the skeletons were from Yorkshire, and we only knew the name of one of them. So we were almost trying to tell the stories of these ordinary people who lived around here in various periods of history. And I think that's really important, because often their voice is lost in the grander stories, you know, that museums tell. And I think it's our, what we should be doing more of is sort of connecting stories of ordinary people as well. But it's just the nature of archaeology, what survives and what doesn't. We have a very skewed picture of the past, and we build up pictures of the past on the evidence that we have, but we're also very aware that that evidence isn't complete and it's quite biased.
Yeah, this doesn't have to be human remains specific, but just generally in terms of like archaeological like excavations and digs, what's your best one, I guess? What do you think's been the best thing that's ever been discovered?
You know, recently I think one of the best things that's been discovered is Must Farm. I don't know if you've heard about Must Farm.
No,
it's a Bronze Age settlement. It's down near Peterborough Way. It was only discovered, I'm going to say, like 5 years ago-ish. It's just really well preserved Bronze Age settlement, and it's sort of, the roundhouses have collapsed in position, so you can still see the way that they fan. I'm doing this weird thing with my hands that nobody can see. Fan out. And that, you know, it's like a snapshot. It's a snapshot through time. I think it's probably, I'm trying to think what date it would be, maybe about 2000 BC. And you just sort of think, wow, that's a snapshot of our ancestors right there. That's really, really exciting. But exciting things are uncovered all the time. There's excavations going on around Leeds all the time who, you know, find really great things. So it's great. And this is how our stories grow in the museum and our objects, new objects get added to the collection.
What's been the best thing that you found on a dig?
That's a great question. I've been on lots of digs, I've never found like one object that's been, wow, that's sort of changed our view of history. But one of the most exciting digs I've been on was in Bahrain in the Middle East, excavating around a 14th century mosque. That was pretty amazing. But I've been on a whole range of excavations before I gave it up to be more comfortable inside.
Yeah, it's not very glamorous, is it?
I'm not built for the outside. I did dig a fair bit in sunny countries, but then museum life was calling.
Brilliant, as it always does. Sarah, I'm really conscious that I've just hogged all of the questions because I feel like I just cannot shut up about
it. It's your favourite thing. It's totally fine.
It's my best one, but I'm actually going to shut up. You can ask some questions now.
Some of the questions, I think we've kind of covered some things that I was like interested in, but because we talked a lot about mummification, you know, I didn't watch the Mummified Alan programme, I have to say, but I will do. But I find it really conflicting having heard about it, just in terms of, you know, the whole having a right to decide what happens at end of life and things, because in our culture, like you say, we make ourselves very removed from death in comparison to other cultures and things. So in terms of preserving or indeed just burying bodies, how does it differ across cultures and continents and things, and do we have evidence of that sort of in our collection?
You know, how the dead are treated varies enormously through time and obviously across the world. You have obviously your standard burials, you have your mummification, which can be either on purpose or naturally. We do have in the collection cremations as well. So we have cremations from the Roman period and the Anglo-Saxon period. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a cremation vessel and the remains of the cremated person inside that vessel. And the cremations themselves can then be either buried or put into some sort of tomb structure as well. So that's how we usually find individuals. There's lots of different, you know, different choices there. So there's a whole range really of ways, but they're the main. It's either human skeletons, mummified remains, or cremations, I would say.
I wonder if over time, because I don't know about you, but I'm all for being burnt to ash, for want of a better.
I would say just throw me in a skip and go for a curry.
you'll end up being, you know, found, and like, what happened to this woman? Like, well, we found her in a skip. But I think, I don't know whether over time that'll change, and human remains will become less of a thing in sort of from a museum aspect as well, because of the ethical concerns, but because of the decisions people make about their end of life choices. And certainly in this country, I think burial is, I don't have any scientific fact for this, but I would assume that it is less popular now because cremation is so, you know, easy to come by, I think.
I think as well, people don't want to necessarily take up space. There's a lot of like land use issues with burial. And I think as well, there's this idea that once you're buried, you will stay there for all time. But as we know, that won't happen. And you know, in several hundred years time, if somebody wants to build a road through where you are, that may well happen. So
yeah,
there is no guarantee. And I think there's also lots of other choices for people now. People want to be buried under a tree, you know, and nothing to mark your grave. There's lots of different ways you can sort of dispose of their body, depending on your belief system a lot of the time.
Kat, is there any historical reason why people would open up a grave? So, you know, like Shakespeare's grave, for example, has a curse written on it. And I watched a program the other day where they were doing research into it and like x-raying the floor and like trying to work out what the deal is with the grave. And it's buried a bit deeper than the ones around it and things like this. But the summary of the program was, we're never going to know actually, because we're never going to go into the grave. So we don't know. But is there ever any, like, what would be like an overpowering reason for someone to open up?
I think the only reason that you would excavate someone out of their grave would be if there was threat of it being destroyed by something and you wanted to preserve those remains, or there was a very strong sort of scientific question that you wanted to answer. I think archaeologists particularly would always prefer to leave bodies where they are, the dead where they are if possible. You know, there are a lot of dead people, you know, they're everywhere. They're in places that you wouldn't even imagine. I can't imagine that it would be allowed that you could go into an actual cemetery and just excavate out of somebody's grave. But then you look at Richard III, he was found, wasn't he, in Leicester, and they were looking for him.
It's one of Meg's best ones.
This is my best absolute one, Kat. I can't believe it. Were you involved in that in any way?
I was not involved in it. Antonia's husband, Bob, was involved in it from the Royal Armoury. Shout out to Bob. He was involved. I was not involved in it at all, but I just watched with fascination at the battle between York and Leicester.
Yeah, where's he been buried? Is it Leicester?
Yeah.
Yeah.
York have put on a couple of, the Yorkshire Museum put on an exhibition about him, and I think they're going to do another one. Obviously, the strong connection. So, but yeah, that's a really good example of someone high status, you know, they were actually looking for him and they found him and excavated him.
Yeah.
But that doesn't usually happen. I believe there was a society, Bob's going to tell me this is completely wrong if he listens to this, but I believe there was some kind of Richard III society who were actively looking for his burial place, and I think they had it narrowed down to several sites, and I can't quite remember how they figured it out, but they did.
Mad. And they did this thing where they like could tell from samples that they'd taken from the bones or from the teeth of what kind of diet the person has had.
Yeah. So if you do like isotope analysis, you can tell not only about past diets but also where somebody actually grew up, because the chemical signature is quite unique in different parts of the world. So you can tell a lot by carrying out different analysis on bones.
My favorite thing about that was that they reconstructed what his face might have looked like by looking at the way that the muscle was attached to the skull or something.
People are so clever, and that's, aren't they?
I mean, we have a facial reconstruction which was done in the 1990s, I believe, of Nessie Amun as well in the gallery. So that was made by x-raying his skull and then building up the tissue the way the muscles would have attached to his skull, and to give, you know, a likeness. Obviously, we'll never know if it's actually that accurate, but it gives a likeness of what he may have looked like. And I think that's quite a powerful thing as well, because as you say, it kind of humanizes people. If you have a skeleton, but then you show a face, you're like, oh, right, yeah, you know.
I think the first thing people always say as well is, including me, look how small they were. Like, they weren't that small. But they were smaller than people are today. But that is everyone's first thing.
The thing,
interesting though is that if you look at the Iron Age skeletons, when we displayed two Iron Age skeletons, so we're talking about 2,000-year-old skeletons from like the Leeds area in the skeletons exhibition. The man, we could just fit him into the case because he was so tall. He's taller than any other skeleton that was on display. We just got him in. We were worried, you know, we were going to have to like miss out a few digits or something because he was so tall. And actually the woman who we displayed them together, she was also like really well preserved and quite tall. So sometimes this idea that people in the past were short isn't always true.
With the reconstruction of Richard III, like obviously the thing about Richard III, like in history, is that he's been demonized by Shakespeare and everyone thinks that he's the bad guy. And they reconstructed his face and everyone's just sort of like, oh, doesn't he look nice? He looks really lovely, actually. It's pretty, he was fine.
He changed your mind completely.
Yeah, he looks really smiley. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you listen to any of the like serial killer podcasts, a lot of serial killers, you know, women liked them and it was weird and it doesn't make them any less bad.
Ted Bundy had a following of women.
Yeah.
He was a real celeb and he was horrific, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because facial reconstructions are also quite controversial, because, you know, people will say that it's crossing a line to try and reconstruct what somebody looked like, just let them rest. And, you know, there is value in whatever, you know, all these opinions, and we'll never get a consensus on it. We just have to try and navigate through it as best we can. And I also think what you said earlier, Sara, was really interesting about how our idea of human remains and our ideas around it will change, and they always will. Like the ethics around human remains and how we view death changes all the time. If you look back at the Victorian period and how people viewed death then compared to now, it's changed a lot in our society here. So I'm sure it will continue to change.
Kat, I swear to God, I could literally talk to you for about 3 hours.
This is the longest podcast ever. You'll have to cut loads of this out.
I'm actually not going to cut any out. I don't care. People can moan. I don't care. This is going to be so interesting.
It's fascinating.
My last actual question about this is just it's a really quick one. Have you ever been to the tombs in Egypt?
I have. I've been to the pyramids in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt, yes, a couple of times, purely as a tourist. not worked over there.
Is it good? What's your best one?
What's my best
one? Number two.
Yeah, the reason one. You know, it is, it's, I mean, you cannot not think it's amazing. You know, it's absolutely incredible. In fact, you go and you are blown away by it. I mean, you see it on the telly and then all of a sudden it's right in front of you. And obviously it's inspiring and it's amazing. And Egypt has always, you know, been a source of fascination for everybody. But then that's the downside of that, is that's why so much Egyptian material is spread around the world and there's so much controversy, because it's always been this viewed as one of these, you know, the cradle of civilization almost, and almost adopted by Westerners and then taken out of context and the objects appropriated and spread around museums. So there's admiration and then there's appropriation, and it's a really fine line. It's something obviously we're all trying to address with the collections we've inherited.
Yeah.
All the time. But as a country now, it's amazing and fascinating, wonderful people. And, you know, obviously it's probably an unparalleled heritage that you can go and see. Absolutely amazing. I recommend it.
Nice. Next time we can jump on a plane.
Yeah.
Yes, too.
Not now. Give it a miss for a bit.
Sarah, I've literally hogged all of those questions, but did you have any more before we got on to the final ones for Kat?
No, I don't think so. I think, I find it really fascinating. And I always take the mick out of Meg because I always say, oh, it's just pots, but only to wind her up, because I actually love archaeology and Kirk's Abbey is like my favourite site. So it's all bants. No one says that. Don't put that in. But yeah,
did you just say it's all bants?
Did
you
I
say
did, bants? And then immediately regretted it and felt like the millennial I am.
I'm going to leave that in.
Yeah,
you so honestly.
Oh, horrendous. But no, I do love coming and bothering you and chatting to you at your desk. So I'm sorry I have not been able to do that for about six
it's
months.
No, it's been really sad not seeing people in real life.
Yeah, really, yeah, it's hard, isn't it?
I miss just sort of the general conversation in the office.
I think it's been nice from our point of view to be able to do the podcasts, because we have got back in touch with people and found out fascinating things, which is nice. It's very condensed, but
condensed. Works. Poor Kat has just spent half a day talking to us.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. You know, I love this subject as well. We should say as well that the report that we wrote of all the results of the visitor survey that we did around skeletons, about visitor opinions, is available on our website, so anyone can go and check that out and see what people thought about human remains.
Nice. I'll put a link in, Kat. I'll put a link in the description so everyone can have a little read of that. Okay, so before you go, you're a listener, so you know what's coming, Kat. Right?
Do you know what's coming?
What's been your favourite day at work?
Now, you know what I'm going to say as a caveat, that, you know, I've been working for the service for 15 years, so it's really hard to choose a favourite day. And I think I've got like an answer which sounds good and then an answer that's really honest.
Okay.
So I
do both.
So one of my favourite days at work, it really has nothing to do with the collection particularly, but it was me and Liz Chadwick went down to, Liz Chadwick was our digital person back in the day. And we went down to, I think it was Crewe, to get our Anglo-Saxon West Yorkshire hoard 3D scanned. And while I was there, they 3D scanned me and I was dead excited as part of, you know, the process. They made a 3D me do a little dance on the screen. And then I was going off on maternity leave and they sent me a 3D print of myself as a gift, which now stands on my desk. It's a bit weird to have a statue of yourself.
I actually remember this because I remember one of the first times I was in the office and I came to your desk and I was like, is that you? Just there?
It's a pregnant me. I took it home and put it on the mantelpiece, but I thought it was really weird to have a statue as well on the mantelpiece. So then I took it back to work and it just sort of creeps people out. So, you know, you do get to do really fun stuff, but, you know, every day is completely different. But what I absolutely love, and this is going to make me sound like a massive nerd, but I love days when I can do cataloguing and everybody kind of leaves me alone.
Like yesterday, you put a picture up on Twitter. And it was all neat and tidy and you were just like, I could just see you just smiling from the inside.
It's because, you know, we're all really busy. We do loads of really exciting, wonderful things. But sometimes, you know, you need to get your back of house sorted in order to be able to use objects. You have to have them catalogued and sorted out. Otherwise, they're not usable. So a day where I can sit on TMS, our catalogue system, and catalogue objects is like a pure joyful day for me. If I've ever got a massive smile on my face, it's probably because I'm on the catalogue system.
Can
see why your face is like, just like, seriously, what's wrong with you?
That is so wild.
To be fair, Emmy said that she loves spreadsheets, so there is a definite theme about organisation. But to be fair, we kind of have to be when there's 1.3 million objects and 9 sites, and you know, it's just a lot.
To be fair, I feel like those drawers you showed me inside your drawers, Kat, and they were so perfectly labelled inside. Little labels of like the cities where each one was found, like, and the towns.
Honestly, it brings me so much joy. It really does. But you know what? If you don't know what you've got and where it is, then you can't get people excited about it. So, you know, it's all in a day's work.
Okay, Kat, you know what's coming now. Firstly, what would be the main takeaway for our listeners from what you've said today? Like a 10-second quick fire, here's what you should know.
Okay, I think one of the most important things about human remains in museums is obviously we should be really respectful of them, but it's what they can teach us about death and dying today. So what I would say is, my takeaway message is, everyone should check out Dying Matters online. Everyone should think about making a death plan, making a will, think about organ donation and planning their own deaths. That would be my takeaway message from today.
Strong. And do you know what? That's the most concise one we've had so far.
That's so good. Everyone else has been like, well, everyone said good things, but you know, yeah, totally admire that.
I know, but it's important.
It is important, you're right. What's your favourite takeaway? Food.
Muay Thai tandoori. I'm sorry, like, curry is absolutely amazing. I'm going to say Muay Thai tandoori, which I'm slightly obsessed with, in Muay Thai in Leeds. They do amazing chana masala. Everything's covered in green chilies. If you have a jalfrezi from there, it will blow your head off. It's amazing. Peshwari naan. There's nothing quite like it. Quite recently, I introduced Muay Thai tandoori to Vanessa Jones, our lovely assistant curator of costume and textiles. And honestly, we ordered so much food. I always decide I want every single side because I think, oh, it's only small, and then you end up with a massive banquet.
A feast.
And so good the next day as well, when you wake up and you realise, I've got leftover curry in the fridge. What joy.
Brilliant. Oh, I've never
That's kind of another food hack, I would say, leftover takeaway for dinner the next day. Good food.
Yeah, and you can even like crisp up your naans in the oven.
Oh, God. Yeah. Brilliant. I also think of whenever, literally, I can be holding a can of chickpeas and you will just pop into my head. Just anything chickpea related is just cat backs, just all
I'm
over.
I'm slightly obsessed with chickpeas. I absolutely love them. And lentils, love
so versatile.
Yeah, really versatile.
So much protein. So much protein, Kat.
Yeah.
Love it.
Brilliant. Right, Kat, thank you so much for coming on the pod. I feel like we can't take up too much more of your time because we've literally just asked you a million questions. But we've been wanting to get you on for so long. So thank you for coming on and asking more questions.
And miss seeing you in real life.
I know, me too. I really miss you both.
I know, sad.
You'll have to get me back on to talk about money at some point.
Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
That's the plan.
I'm probably playing myself now.
Little spoiler alert, I'm going to get her back on to talk about money.
No, Kat, tell us about the exhibition that you're planning.
Oh, yeah.
So there's an exhibition called Money Talks, which opens in February in Leeds City Museum. So it's stories about people and cash. So it's looking at collections across the museum. It's archaeology, it's social history, it's all different collections. And it's looking at all the different things we do with money in terms of traditions, counterfeiting, burying coin hoards. It's going to be really quite exciting.
Yeah.
And Sarah's working on the marketing, so it's obviously wonderful.
Kat, we'll book you in for another 4-hour interview for that one, shall we?
Yeah. I look forward to that.
Right, well, I basically hijacked that and asked all the questions. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I had a really good biscuit to eat. So.
Oh, yeah. What was it?
It's very good. It's got chocolate and icing sugar and it's good. And Amy made it and she's very good. There we go.
Brilliant. Well done. Yeah, I could honestly have just had Kat on for 3, maybe 4 hours just asking her endless questions about that, because literally I can't believe it. I can't believe how interesting it is.
It is, but it's a fascinating subject regardless of whether you work in museums or not. I think we're kind of obsessed with the macabre and how different death is treated across the world and how it's something we can never escape from. It's one of those things that's kind of weird.
Death is kind of weird.
Yeah.
What was your best bit?
I really liked learning about, it was right at the end when she was talking about Richard III and how you can find stuff out from their teeth about where people have come from and how they grew up, because the chemical analysis is so specific to different areas. And I kind of knew that, but I also didn't at all. And I was like, whoa, that's fascinating.
But also with that, I was gonna interrupt her and then I didn't, because I was like, that's just insanely rude. So the thing about the Richard III, his teeth, was that they found out because basically back in the 1400s, if you had a diet rich in fish, which is what the teeth showed, you were a really high status individual.
Mm, so that's fish how was pricey.
What's that got to do with the price of fish on a Friday, you know?
Everything Richard apparently.
That's what. That's why they were like, oh, he's a really high status, could be a king. Because if he'd like been eating like meat and like grains or whatever, I don't know.
You know, corpse food.
But isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is amazing.
I love that. That's my absolute best one.
What was your best learn? Was it that or was it something different?
I think the stuff about preservation, I find that really interesting, and bog body. I didn't know that bog bodies were a thing until literally like 3 or 4 months ago and looked at pictures. Genuinely, anyone listening, I would really recommend looking up and watching the documentary on mummifying Alan and watching the documentary on Richard III. It's called The King in the Car Park and it's my best one. But they're really interesting and really like good context for what we've talked about today. So have a little watch of those if you haven't already.
Awesome.
Yeah. Good. God, look at us giving people resources.
Isn't it? I know, right? But it's just like a wealth of stuff and it's always changing. And I think that's what's fascinating about it is that, I think people think of archaeology as just in the past, but it's not. It's all the time. It's everything. So there we are.
There we go. Who have we got on next time?
Next time we have Claire Brown.
Yay! She's so good.
Yeah,
she is. Also, Claire Brown, for context, Claire Brown is one of our natural science curators. She job shares with Rebecca Machen. So she's going to come on and I think talk about how we collect natural science objects and talk a lot about the ethics of it and decolonizing the natural science collection and what we need to do. I found a picture on my phone of where Claire Brown had made cream eggs.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, she went on like a bakery course with Betty's or something. And she is just ridiculous. She makes so many delicious things. And she made cream eggs. And had like, it was like really thick chocolate. And inside it was like mascarpone cream with a passion fruit curd.
Oh, God, that sounds incredible.
Unbelievable. So yeah, tune in for that because that's going to be lovely.
Big thank you to Tim Bentley, who does our delicious theme tune, Meg and I sing quite badly between each of our bits where we edit. Also a big thanks to Alex Finney for our lovely cover artwork.
Going out for dinner with Al tonight.
Are you?
Oh, yeah, nice. Going to the Reliance for their eat out to help out thing.
Oh, cute. Oh, I miss the Reliance. Oh, yeah. Say hello. Say hello from someone I've literally never met either of these people. One day. We did have a date planned, but lockdown happened.
We were going to take Tim and Alex out for a little dinner, but, you know, then the pandemic and that, so we couldn't.
Yeah, we'll get it reorganised. It's all good. It's on record now, so we have to do it as well. So if you liked this and others, please subscribe. It's really helpful to us and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We know everyone doesn't have that, but if you could leave us some nice messages anyway, it just really helps our ego. But mainly means that we can carry on doing these, which is great. Transcripts will be available on the website. We'll put links into anything more specific that we've spoken about as well. And then if you want to chat to us or ask us a question or have any feedback at all, you can find us on socials. We are at Leeds Museums for the big one, and then my handle is at Sarah L Merritt and Meg's is
at Museum Meg.
Yeah, that wasn't as smooth as I was hoping it to be, but I also didn't tee you up, so I apologize.
You did. I felt do you know what, because I've just been talking,
I just ran away with it
such a long time, I just felt like I hadn't spoken. I was just like drifting off a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah, basically I'm Museum Meg.
Yeah
so what do we say now? Is that all the fun?
Because you asked me who's coming up next and that's at the bottom and now we've already done that bit. So
oh God, we're a mess. We're okay, well, thanks for doing the thanks, Mez.
Welcome.
Yeah, tune in next week when we've got Claire Brown, kids.
Yeah.
Cool. Right, have a good one.
See you later.
Bye.